Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Hello, and welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast, Explainer episode number 67. Today, we are joined once again by Director of Health Policy Studies at the Cato Institute, Michael Cannon, and Executive Vice President of the Goldwater Institute, Christina Sandifer. Thank you both for joining us today.
Well, thanks so much. And Michael, it's always great to talk to you about these interesting and complex issues. And as always, thank you to the Federalist Society for hosting our conversation. So Michael, last time you and I recorded, we were actually talking about your new or new-ish now, I guess, book Recovery, which is about the many problems that government intervention causes in the U.S. healthcare sector and some of your proposed solutions. So first, I just want to say if listeners missed that conversation, I recommend you go back and listen. We hit on a whole bunch of different topics and, of course, pick up Michael's excellent book to learn a lot more that we weren't able to get into on the podcast. But today, we're going to talk about something a little bit different. I think it's perhaps one of the least expected topics that you address in the book, and that is how government healthcare affects foreign policy, and namely how government healthcare policy is potentially causing unnecessary wars. So that is a very interesting topic. But first, I think let's provide a little bit of context before we dive into that. So, you know, it probably won't surprise listeners to learn that the Department of Veterans Affairs, or the VA as we call it, does a really poor job of taking care of those who have served our country. I think we've all seen the headlines, but it might surprise listeners to learn just how poorly the VA's been doing its job. And you talk about this in the book. You mentioned a figure. I think you said that the VA spent about $128 billion with a B dollars last year to provide medical care to beneficiaries. So tell us a little bit about what people are getting for that money, for those tax dollars, and how this system operates.
So thank you, Christina and the Federalist Society, for having me out again to talk about my book, Recovery. It is a guide to reforming the health sector, and part of that health sector is the Veterans Health Administration. This is a really unique part of the U.S. health sector. It's for a specific population, veterans of the U.S. military, but it's also unique because unlike the Medicare program or the Medicaid program, which are much bigger than the VA, The VA is kind of the United States' own version of the British National Health Service, where the government owns the hospitals and employs the doctors, rather than Medicare or Medicaid, where the government's just writing checks to people. And that makes it a very different animal, and so it behaves in different ways. But it also means that it really sort of behaves like the British National Health Service does, where there might be some things that it does really well, but there are some things that it does extremely poorly. And one of the things that it does poorly is it doesn't get resources to where people need them, because it doesn't, it's an entirely government-run system. It functions on the basis of bureaucratic rationing, and so it doesn't have a price system to get the doctors or build the hospitals in the areas where veterans need them. And so you have these hotspots where shortages persist, and you live in one of them.
Yes.
Christina, Arizona, the Phoenix area is one of the areas where there have been not just waiting lists, but waiting lists to get on waiting lists and hidden waiting lists because the VA is shortchanging veterans so much.
Yes. In fact, about a decade ago, my former Goldwater Institute colleague, Mark Flatton, wrote about the Phoenix VA system and how long, I think people were waiting upwards of like a third of a year to be able to get an appointment there. It was absurd.
They even started developing British accents. They were waiting so long. And at the same time, there are parts of the country where the VA has too many resources and there's idle capacity. And a government system without a price mechanism and cost-conscious consumers has a very hard time taking those resources from where people don't need them and applying them to where people need them. And so you get persistent gluts and shortages, that both of which are depriving humans of things that they need often to live. And yet that's not even remotely the worst part of the Veterans Health Administration.
Well, before we get to that part, let's talk a little bit about some of these wait times. I think that's probably what people are most familiar with if they know anything about the VA is that they saw those headlines about a decade ago with people having to wait a really long time for care. Or, you know, a lot of us have family members who are veterans or friends who are veterans and see them, you know, wait even longer than we have to be able to get care, see doctors. But one of the things that I thought was interesting and kind of telling about government healthcare and government in general in the book is you talked about when all this came out. And I think it wasn't just that we found out how long people were waiting, but also that there were some fabrications going on where the VA was actually kind of trying to downplay or even just lie about how long people were having to wait. What does Congress do? Well, Congress appropriates more money because that's really all Congress knows how to do when anything is going wrong. And I just think that's funny. You were talking about comparing this to a system where there's in the market where there's actually a price system to guide things. Of course, in a market, there's also, you know, profit and loss and incentives. And I think this is what usually happens. Like when a private company fails this spectacularly, it goes out of business and it loses all of its money. But when government fails, you know, ironically, it gets more money, right? So how has this affected the VA? I mean, this was about a decade ago. So in the past 10 years or so, throwing more money at the problem helped, hurt, done nothing? What's changed?
Well, it has led to some policy change. What the VA has done is similar to what other government-run systems have done when access is proven inadequate, when the government has proven itself incapable of arranging the resources to meet the needs of the target population. The government has said, well, we'll throw more money at the problem by allowing people to go outside the government system, and the government will write checks to the healthcare providers that they then see. So that's what's been happening in the VA, and sometimes it expands access to care, but other times it does not. Other times the bureaucracy involved leaves patients waiting nearly or just as long as they were waiting before. And as you say, though, it creates the problem that you're rewarding failure by throwing more money at a broken system. But even to the extent it does succeed in reducing the wait times, you run into a problem that you see in other government-run systems when they get their wait times down. One of the reasons is that or when they throw more money at the problem, the wait times don't necessarily come down, because if you reduce the wait times, you are reducing part of the price of accessing these services, and you will then encourage more people to try to consume these services. You will if the wait price falls, demand curves slope downward, and so more people will demand a larger quantity of these services. Either people who are already in the system will say, okay, maybe I will try to get that appointment because the waits aren't so bad, the waits could persist that way. Or people who were eligible but had not enrolled will try to enroll in the VA if it turns out the quality of care is better than they thought it was when they decided to choose private insurance instead. And there's some of that going on in the VA as well.
Sure, it's like when you're at Disneyland, right? And you have the app that shows you how long the wait times are. And when you see that you have to wait 3 hours to ride Peter Pan, then some people say, well, maybe not worth it. Maybe we'll come back. And then that wait time goes down, and then people can make decisions. I think it's good to remember that it's not just money that is a cost, but wait times and other opportunity costs are costs as well. And people are going to make decisions based on those factors changing.
That's right. And so in the book, what I propose is that if you want to provide veterans the best care for the money that Congress is spending on them. What you want to do is you want to give that money to the veterans and let them spend it on health insurance according to their needs and their preferences. And when they've got that money in their hands, then they will be, the way that they spend it will send signals to healthcare providers that, hey, we need more resources here in Phoenix. And that will, the providers will respond to those price signals that, that the veterans who now control the money will be sending, and that will get you a much better matching of resources to need. It'll also help to dissipate those gluts in those other areas of the country where we don't need all that spending, because if there aren't that many veterans there, then you're just not sending that much money there anymore. Sure. And you will be sending it to the areas where there are lots of veterans who are not getting their needs met. One prong of the reform proposal is to just however much money you want to spend on the veterans. And I'm, as a libertarian, I don't have a principled objection to spending more money on veterans benefits. It's an employee benefit for a type of government employee that I want to exist.
Right.
So if you want to spend more money on veterans benefits, fine, but give it to the veterans and let them spend it, and then let the price system and markets provide them, do a better job than the current VHA is of meeting those needs. The second prong of the reform proposal is to change the ownership of the Veterans Health Administration. As I mentioned, this is a fully socialized healthcare system, one that has physical assets. It owns land, it owns equipment, and it has a reputation. It has a workforce, and this is a corporation. Not unlike other socialized enterprises that, say, the former Soviet states privatized after the fall of the Berlin Wall. And that's what Congress should be doing with the VA. Turn it into if you want to serve veterans, turn it into a shareholder-owned corporation, and then just privatize it by giving the shares away to veterans. So not only would Congress be giving them the cash to purchase the medical care and other services that they need, it would also give, my reform proposal would give veterans ownership over the VA, so that they could that would be a huge wealth transfer to veterans, and it would also give them control, literal ownership and control over the VA, the VHA, in a way that they've never had before. But I think the most important part of the reform proposal and how I would execute these things has to do with what you mentioned at the beginning, and the effect that the VA has, or the way Congress finances veterans benefits, has on foreign policy. And the reforms that I propose in the book would not only improve care for veterans and make them wealthier, it would also result in fewer dead and disabled veterans, because it would change the way Congress and the president do foreign policy so that they would put active duty military personnel at risk much less often.
Yeah. So let's jump into that juicy part. So your claim in the book is that the way the VA operates, it makes it easier for our government to not only enter, but perpetuate wars, in part because of what we've been talking about throughout this podcast, right? That Congress can't run a proper cost benefit analysis. Like you said, the VA means a government entity, but it is providing benefits to employees, to government employees. But the financial costs of these benefits, as you point out in the book, a lot of them don't fully accrue until much later. So we see this happen a lot when governmental entities, whether it be Congress, whether it be state legislators, whether it be city council members, I mean, a lot of times regulations or policies are made just based on what that individual thinks is politically popular, or maybe even just what they think is right to do in a vacuum, but they don't have a full understanding of the cost. Whereas when businesses or when individuals make decisions, they weigh costs against the potential benefits. And of course, there are a lot of costs associated with starting or entering or perpetuating a war. But one of those costs is these benefits, right? So walk us through that and how the way these things function and are set up lead to making it a lot easier for Congress and the president, I guess these days more so the president than Congress, to make these decisions.
Right. So the United States, as the largest military in the world, we deployed, we have bases, countries around the world, we deploy troops in various places around the world, including places like in the very Eastern Mediterranean right now, in Syria and Iraq, where those troops are at risk. And the financial cost of doing that affects U.S. foreign policy. And the veterans, the way that Congress finances veterans benefits hides the largest fiscal cost of any military action that would put U.S. lives at risk. So as examples of how sensitive politicians are to the cost of military operations, wars, and so forth, I'm old enough to remember when President George W. Bush fired one of his economic advisors, Larry Lindsey, for having the temerity, the gall, to estimate that that invading Iraq would someday cost $200 billion. It has proven to be even more expensive than that, far more expensive than the amount, the projection for which President Bush fired Larry Lindsey. It's been, some people have estimated it's $1 or $2 trillion, not just $200 billion. And when Presidents Obama and Biden withdrew some or all troops from Afghanistan, they would tout the savings, the fiscal benefits of doing so, because that's an important part, it's an important consideration. Congress does face some constraints. Or the Congress and the president faced some constraints on their ability to engage in military conflict because of the cost of that. Well, you know, the most expensive part of any military conflict is the cost of veterans benefits.
Now, you might ask, anyone thinks about that.
I mean, how could that possibly be? I mean, veterans benefits? Come on, yeah. You're talking tanks, you're talking bombers, you're talking aircraft carriers.
Exactly.
And then are you out of your mind? Well, but think about it like this. Veterans benefits don't just end when the war ends. Okay. The Vietnam War ended 50 years ago, but there are still 1.7 million Vietnam era veterans benefit recipients who are receiving disability payments.
Wow.
And those cost about $30 billion per year right now, and they are still climbing. They haven't peaked yet. They haven't started to fall off yet, even though that war was 50 years ago. And that's why veterans benefits are so expensive. It's because they don't peak until 50 years after a conflict ends. And even then, they keep going. And because these obligations fall, Congress keeps paying them for decades after the war ends. That's what makes them the most expensive part of any war. And a really stark example is, I'll often ask audiences, Christina, can you guess when was the last year that Congress paid out Civil War era veterans benefits?
You know, I know a little bit about this topic, but I don't know when the last year was.
It was 2020.
Wow, 2020.
It was 4 years ago. It was 155 years after Appomattox, because one soldier had a daughter very wow. late in life, and she just died.
Wow.
In 2020, and so she was receiving those benefits. So these are incredibly expensive, and yet when Congress is doing its budgeting for military actions and veterans, it's not including veterans benefits.
Yeah.
It's not including the additional cost of putting troops in harm's way in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Syria right now. And as a result, Congress and the president are able to put U.S. lives at risk. while hiding the costs, which makes it easier for them to put U.S. lives at risk. And if you want to know how much could the cost of veterans' benefits affect U.S. foreign policy decisions, well, consider that right now the budget for the entire Department of Veterans Affairs is about $300 billion, and the budget for the Defense Department is about $800 billion, or Congress just passed a bill in December that a defense bill that was about $900 billion. But there are official projections that suggest that if Congress were to fund the veterans' benefits promises that it makes when it incurs them, in 2023, it would have had to scrape up an additional $2 trillion. That's because since 2022, active duty personnel accrued another $200 billion in benefits, and Congress created new benefits for current veterans. That's another $800 billion. And then there's another $1 trillion that the other $1 trillion is benefits for which Congress previously underestimated the cost. So if Congress wanted to keep deploying troops the ways it is deploying them right now all around the globe, and cover the entire cost of that in real time, it would have had to put away an extra $2 trillion, which is more than the combined budgets of the departments of the Defense and Veterans Affairs. This is serious money we're talking about. $1 trillion here and $1 trillion there may not sound like much, but you add it up and pretty soon it becomes real money. And there's just no way that Congress and the president would be able to maintain U.S. military posture the way that it is if it had to come up with all of that money in real time. They would have to make some changes. They would have to put U.S. troops at risk less often. They would not be nearly, they're being extremely cavalier about that right now because they don't have to pay the full cost. So the reforms that I put forward in my book, Recovery, would force Congress to come up with the money to fund veterans' benefits at the time it makes those commitments, not 50 years down the road, but at the time it makes those commitments to veterans, it'd have to fund those. It could do it with deficits. Okay. I'm not saying there has to, there have to be tax increases associated with this. I think there should be, sure, rather than deficit spending. But fund them in real time, because then when Congress is contemplating war, the cost of those veterans' benefits will rise, and they will then make those decisions with a much clearer picture of the costs and benefits of military conflict. Remember, Barack Obama raked Hillary Clinton across the coals for her vote on the authorization for the use of military force in Iraq. She said she made the best decision she could with the information she had at that time. She did not have information about the long-term cost of veterans' benefits. If Congress had to face those costs when it was making that decision, we might not have gone into Iraq, which I think most people agree now was a mistake. We might not have lost the 4,500 soldiers who lost their lives in Iraq. And it doesn't mean that we wouldn't be able to defend the United States. We would still be able to defend the United States. We just wouldn't be engaging in military conflict in these marginal cases where the benefits clearly do not outweigh the costs. But the problem is that when Congress conceals the cost of veterans' benefits this way, it distorts that debate about the use of force, and then it hides both the largest fiscal obstacle to putting U.S. lives at risk, and it hides the largest fiscal benefit of reducing that risk. So the hawks don't have to justify the full cost of their policies, and the doves cannot show the full benefits of their policies. So the way I put it is, the way we fund veterans' benefits right now is heads war wins, tails military families lose.
Yeah. Well, two things come to mind. One is that I mentioned that I knew a little something about the Civil War veterans' benefits. My favorite president, Grover Cleveland, actually was famous for, and this shows you just how much the thinking on this has changed and the transparency has changed. He was famous for going through and he was president at the very end. Well, he was famously the only president to have served two non-consecutive terms, but his first term started in 1885. So, yes, a while after the Civil War ended, and he would sit down himself as, you know, the commander in chief, and he would go through these claims for individual veterans' benefits and pensions and make sure that they were being spent the right way and, you know, making sure that people were getting what they were due, but that we weren't overspending. And because he was familiar with what the budget was supposed to have been. And I love that. I mean, I love that story about him. Can you even imagine? And here now, fast forward to, you know, 2024, and we don't, apparently up until a few years ago, we're still paying Civil War benefits out, but we don't even know on the front end. There would be no way for a president or for someone in the VA or for Congress or for anybody to even hold anyone accountable for those expenditures, because we didn't even know going in to the conflict what those expenditures were. And I mean, this is in an era where when you talk about the Civil War, I mean, that was also an era of rampant inflation. But nevertheless, like, there was still some transparency and accountability. So it's not a perfect apples to apples story, but
I would love to shrink the federal government so much that the president had nothing to do but sit there,
right,
and adjudicate veterans benefits claims and monitor the spending. He may have even, Grover Cleveland may have even looked at the spending on that particular veteran who fathered the woman who died in 2020 and was the last Civil War era veterans benefit recipient.
Yes. Yep. I completely agree. So I like that story and it shows how far we've come, but that kind of leads to my second point/question for you. And that is, you know, you're talking about trillions of dollars, which are unbelievable amounts of money, but in the past, I mean, in our lifetimes, Michael, it's incredible government spending, how much it has increased, how much deficit spending has increased, how much the national debt has increased. And so I guess my question is, I mean, this is all fascinating. And I do think I am a big proponent of making government officials realize and understand the costs of their decisions and then making that known to their constituents. But do you think, given the way that Congress just seems willing to make all sorts of irresponsible financial decisions and pass the buck down the line, do you think even with these proposed reforms that it would make a difference in Congress's decision making? Or do you think, like you say, a trillion here, a trillion there, nobody pays attention anymore?
So I think that, you know, one possible scenario is that Congress enacts these reforms that I put forward in the book. They have to pay for veterans benefits in real time. And they don't pay any attention. They say, whatever, we'll just add it to the deficit. I doubt that would happen. It would be extremely irresponsible of Congress to do that. And it would hasten the day that the United States faces a debt crisis. Right now, the national debt is about 100% of U.S. GDP. It's going to keep rising unless Congress does something different. And we just don't know what's going to happen because we've never entered that sort of territory before. One fears that we could be headed for a Greek-style debt crisis where people will not buy Treasury bill loan money to the federal government anymore. And then we're going to have to see some pretty drastic austerity measures. I hope that would not happen. I have to expect that if Congress puts in place this set of veterans benefits reforms, that having to throw around money like that, having to reveal to the public, the voters, the kinds of commitments that the government is making on their behalf, will spur a lot more voters to demand that Congress do something about deficits and pay for more of this spending with current tax revenues, which then should lead Congress to reduce those spending levels. Because one of the reasons why deficits and the national debt are so high right now is because we're not having to pay for it. If Congress faced a balanced budget constraint, some sort of mechanism that required them to balance the budget so that they would have to raise taxes by $1 trillion in order to eliminate the federal deficit, I think what would happen is that would make so many taxpayers so much angrier that they would then support candidates who would actually cut spending in a way that we just haven't seen, because we haven't been making we haven't been making enough taxpayers angry. So I have to think that those sorts of numbers would lead to more taxpayers, more voters getting angry and demanding that their members of Congress do something about deficits and out of control spending. And one of the ways I have to imagine they would seek to reduce spending is by reducing the ways in which the government puts U.S. lives at risk abroad.
Yeah. And, you know, taking it back to that healthcare consumer, you know, when we've talked before, we've talked about general patients and consumers of healthcare, but here we're talking about members of the military and veterans. I would think that reform, but also just the trifecta of reforms that you are proposing here, would not only make Congress and the president maybe a little bit more thoughtful about the decisions they make, and it might be a little bit better for taxpayers, but I would think it would also make the military or military service potentially more attractive to people who, you know, are thinking about going into a career in the military. Yes.
I think so. So there'd be a number of benefits in the suite of reforms for active duty military personnel and their families. The way that I propose delivering health and disability and life insurance benefits to veterans is that Congress collects bids from private insurance companies about how much it would cost to provide a standard package of benefits to people in different job categories in the U.S. military, and then just increases military pay commensurate with those premium quotes, those bids that the insurance companies put in. You just increase pay for desk jockeys and for paratroopers and so forth, because those would be risk-rated insurance premium quotes. The paratroopers would get a bigger bump up in pay so that they would have enough to purchase a standard set of veterans benefits at actuarially fair rates. But you give them the money and you let them choose the insurance company that'll provide them these services. And when that happens, when the insurance companies start providing those bids based on the risk of individual, not just jobs, but career paths within the military, military personnel and their families will be able to make their career choices with much more information about what sorts of jobs pose what kind of risk. And if you're a risk-seeking individual, you may love that. You may want to choose your job based on which ones carry the highest veterans benefit premiums, because if you're that sort of a thrill seeker. But if you want to have a safer path, you're starting a family, you're concerned about you're more concerned about those sorts of risks, you'll have more information to make those decisions. And on top of that, the care that you will be getting once you leave active duty and start using these veterans benefits will be better than what veterans are getting through the VA right now. Because for a number of reasons. One, you'll have more competition. You'd be able to buy your benefits. You wouldn't have to go to a monopoly provider like the VA. You could choose from a bunch of different insurance companies who would compete to provide those benefits. But one of the organizations competing for your business would be the newly privatized Veterans Health Administration that is now run by veterans for veterans.
Yep.
So that you would be able to go someplace where you knew people spoke your language, where you knew people understood what kind of needs you have, that specialize in the particular needs that veterans have, the particular needs of amputees, and specialize in treating PTSD among veterans and so forth. And so not only would this suite of reforms improve the experience that active duty, not only would it improve the experience that active duty personnel have while they are serving in the military by helping them choose the right career path for them, keeping them out of harm's way unless absolutely necessary, it would also provide them better care once they leave the VA.
I want to...
Once they leave active duty and begin using their veterans benefits.
Yes, yes. Well, I think, you know, so we've talked about some of the things, or many of the things, that the VA system is currently set up does wrong. We've talked about ways that we could fix that and make it better. I want to end by talking about if there's anything that the VA does right. One thing that I thought was interesting a few years ago at the Goldwater Institute where I work, we were working on some scope of practice reforms, which I know you do a lot over at Cato as well. And one of them was we were trying to expand the scope of practice of pharmacists to allow them to be able to test for things like strep throat and then prescribe an antibiotic, which is allowed in some states in the US and many, many countries around the world, because of course, if you think about it, it's a fairly simple test, it's a fairly simple treatment. But if it goes untreated, strep throat can become very serious, it can become life-threatening, and a lot of people aren't able to see a doctor quickly or within the hours that the workday might allow them to do so. Well, what I had found out is that the VA actually made this scope reform. They put this into place some years ago. And I think probably the reason they did it was in response to everything that had come about out about the just astronomical wait times that people were having to wait just for even very simple things that, again, could become very serious if they had to wait a long time. And so we actually had somebody from the VA come and testify about that system in the state legislature in Arizona and talk about, you know, how long the wait time used to be to see somebody, to see a doctor to treat, say, diagnose and treat strep throat. And that when they allowed pharmacists to do it who were trained the same way, who are trained to be able to do these things, it dramatically decreased wait times and it allowed more patients to be able to be seen and dealt with and get better sooner. And again, I think that wasn't so much the VA being forward-thinking and innovative, but maybe being forced into that situation because things had gotten so bad. But I'm curious if there are other things that the VA has done right, maybe by necessity, or if you think that the system is just overall just very, very poor.
So that is a great question. I'm glad you asked, because I love talking about the VA because it's such a my perspective on it is so counterintuitive for many libertarians. For one thing, I don't mind if Congress spends more money on the VA, if that's what is necessary in order to defend the United States from enemies, foreign and domestic, because because the Constitution authorizes the military, and that's part of the cost of doing business, and that's fine. I don't think it has to spend more, but I don't have a principled objection to it. And likewise, even though it's a government-run enterprise, I love talking about the things that the VA does right, because and it's not because it's a government-run enterprise that it does certain things right. It's because it's that special kind of enterprise that we described at the beginning, where you have all of the doctors and all of the hospitals and pharmacies and clinics and so forth that are part of a single entity. And when you have that sort of a fully integrated system where it receives a fixed budget per year so that it doesn't get more money when it performs more services like most doctors and hospitals do, thanks to government. When you have that sort of system, it does some pretty remarkable things that the rest of the U.S. health sector is lacking terribly. Like one thing is it does tons of research. It does the VA does tons of research because they have this defined patient population, and they're able to monitor this group and compare them to that group and see if this intervention did the intervention group did better than the control group. It's able to do those things, and it so it generates it's this engine of medical research, which is something that the U.S. health sector and the world I think are sorely lacking. And it's able to do these things because in the 1970s and 80s, a bunch of nerds at the VA said, "You know what? This would be a lot easier if we digitized our health records," and they developed on their own electronic health records. Most people still don't, in the private sector of the United States, still don't have electronic health records, yet the VA was innovating in that way. Now, that's not because government is particularly good at this. It happened because you had entrepreneurial people inside of a government system who saw an opportunity that structure, that integrated health system structure created, and they just sought to capitalize on it. And it happened in spite of the fact that there are all sorts of layers of this government bureaucracy that were trying to kill it. But it's not unique to government that sort of thing happens. We do have a private sector version of the NHS and the VHA in the United States. We call it Kaiser Permanente. It is basically the only fully integrated prepaid health system that has broken through all the barriers the government has put in the way of that way of financing and delivering care. It happened because Henry Kaiser was a billionaire and was able to use his money to break through those barriers. They developed electronic medical records too, starting in the 1960s, I think before the VA did. So this isn't government is better. This is these are the benefits that you get when you have an integrated prepaid system like that. And there are lots more of those benefits that we could talk about. And that's also, I think, another benefit of privatizing the VA. For 100 years now, government regulation and government tax policy and government subsidies have either favored or disfavored by subsidizing the competition, or it was just flat out penalized, blocked, barred from entry, these sorts of integrated health systems. But if we so the only places they exist are basically on the West Coast in a couple spots, Portland and Seattle and Northern California. And so if we privatize the VA, then just about every state, every state in the union would have one of these private, would have one of these integrated health systems that could compete to cover others in the private sector and inject some desperately needed competition into the rest of the health sector. So these reforms to veterans benefits could also help, in addition to helping active duty military personnel and veterans, could also help non-veterans by improving the performance of the entire health sector. By making everyone else compete against this sort of system from which, competition against which the government has been protecting them from for 100 years.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that's really great about your book and these conversations, Michael, is that you get into these nuances. I think a lot of people fall into the oversimplification in understanding how the U.S. healthcare system works or doesn't work. And they think about government and they think about the market. And when they don't like something, they blame it on the market, when the truth is we don't, as we have said many times, we don't really have a true market in healthcare and healthcare services here in the United States. And to the extent that some things are done well, or if we see aspects of the VA that are done well, it's unfortunate that government makes it very difficult for that to be replicated in the private sector just because of regulations and barriers that stand in the way. So I think there's a lot to learn there. You've certainly given listeners a lot to think about. And believe it or not, listeners, we have really barely just scratched the surface of all the information that Michael has packed into the book Recovery. So again, I highly recommend, if you haven't read it yet, pick up a copy, go back and listen to our previous podcast. And thanks always, Michael, for a great conversation. And thanks to the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project for hosting us.
Thank you, Christina.
On behalf of the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch Podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.